So I suspect the panelists, most of you are likely familiar with. Stephen Downes is with the National Research Council, and he's probably, as he notes in his bio, best known for the work that he's done with Oil Daily. And it's something that's probably as close as you get to a definitive source of ed tech news in the field. So he's been doing that for well over a decade now, and certainly is prominent as well in the speaker circuit too. I've had the pleasure of I'll use that word loosely for both of our benefits, but I've had the pleasure of running numerous open online courses with Stephen there, now referred to as MOOCs, and the attention seems to be shifting from some of our early pioneering work into those organizations such as Udacity and others that are doing this on a different scale or with you know, different intent than what we had. But nonetheless, so that's Stephen that we've interacted with over a fair bit over the last several years, and he's certainly a strong advocate for openness in education. Now I'm just quickly looking through it. We're going to go with Mark here. So Mark McCutcheon is the assistant prof in literary studies at Athabasca University. You'll also see links to his Twitter profile as well as his blog. He's very active. We have a social service here at Athabasca called The Landing, and it's something that John will likely talk about a little bit more during our session later on today. And he's certainly a significant contributor to the development of the social media culture within Athabasca University. Such a pleasure to have him involved. And Tony Bates, again, I suspect many of you are familiar with him already. He is, as I think Stephen referred to him once, he's forgotten more about the edtech field than most of us will ever know in our lifetime. And that certainly is the case if you follow him on his blog or have interacted with him in the past. Extremely well informed on what's happening in e-learning, distance education, and the edtech space in general. So with that, as our three panelists, we're going to start with Stephen as the opening reactor, and then we'll have Mark, and then we'll have Tony respond, and then from there we'll move into a more conversation type of format. I've put up a blank whiteboard here, so for those of you who like to doodle and draw while you're sitting at your computer, feel free to grab a pen and mark things up. Also encourage you to ask questions or provide reactions to either the speakers or to the presentations that we had earlier as well. Stephen, over to you.
Well, thanks, George. And my first reaction is it's actually kind of hard to react to a video. You wouldn't think so, but I noticed myself listening differently to the video recording than I would be listening to Michael directly. So that I found a little bit disconcerting. I wanted him to be here because I wanted to ask him a question. The other day, somebody parked their car right at the end of my driveway. I have a photo on Flickr to prove it. Too loud, you say? Seriously? Okay. That might be better. Is the audio better now? Okay, great. Sorry about that. I just kind of crank up the volume. Anyhow, there was this car that was parked at the end of my driveway and blocking me in. I took a couple photos of the car. And then the owner came back, and I went running out and took a couple of photos of the owner who had parked her car. Actually, it was a big red truck, which made it all the worse. And I had a nice conversation after with the Constable Willett with the RCMP about the legality of the photographs, the taking of the photographs and the use of the photographs. And he told me that it would be illegal for me to post these photographs online. And I wondered about that. And he wasn't able to cite any specific law, which I thought was a little odd, but there you go. And just policemen aren't lawyers. So, okay. And I was going to ask Michael Geist if I am in fact allowed. But it points to, I think, something that I wish he had addressed a bit more in this talk. Because it kind of went through, it was the standard, here's the legislation, here's what it says, here's the opposition to it. And we ran through that theme about 10 times. We went from the blackout protests, and of course we had the discussion in the chat room about the blackouts of earlier years, and the one that took place, I remember I took place place in that one back in 96, and then the Blue Ribbon campaign, all protesting the Communication Decency Act, which everybody knew was an Internet Censorship Act sponsored by the publishers. In fact, Time magazine came out with these scandalous articles about it. And the mushroom cloud or tree, I'm going to go with mushroom cloud. What I wanted to see from Mike was a bit of a look at the balance between the different kinds of rights and privileges that different organizations have. Because, you know, security for companies and corporate data is one thing, but it's balanced by security for personal data and personal computers. The right of corporations to write about such and such a topic is balanced on the other side by the right of people to write about such and such a topic. And just today, and Michael carried it in his own blog, was a thing about some regulations being postulated by the CRTC, and here they are, they're in the chat room, showing, and I see that Blackboard Collaborate has put little icons in front of each one of them. That I had nothing to do with the little icons. That's entirely Blackboard's doing. Although I think it's very interesting. I guess keystrokes correspond to that. Okay. Oh, isn't that wild? That is amazing. Okay. So anyhow, and basically what these regulations covered were things that software had to get a user's permission in order to do. So, you know, collecting personal information, you have to get permission. Changing or interfering with settings. It's like LinkedIn changing my digest from daily to weekly. I don't want LinkedIn to do it, but it just does it without even asking. Changing or interfering with data, etc., etc. And the intent, of course, was to stop things like spyware, but they also interferes with things like digital rights management, Sony's rootkit, etc. If we had a set of rights that protected personal interests as well as protecting corporate interests, then the legislation being proposed to protect corporate interests would not be so odious. As it stands, though, there is no balance. And as it stands, it's like fighting in the courts. Even if you do have the same rights, if it's you versus a large corporation, it's going to be an uneven battle. And it almost doesn't matter what the legislation says. And you get that feeling, you know, looking at some of the things that Michael talked about, the letter writing campaigns against the various sorts of legislation, the overwhelming weight of the legislation on one side of the issue, and the government turning around and doing the other side of the issue. So I think there are some deeper issues running here, and these are issues that are deeper than just, can we copy stuff produced by a publisher? What is fair use, and can they force us to take down stuff we put on our website? I think the deeper issues have to do with what are the rights of individuals in today's society when held up against the rights of corporations, and the large and the powerful, and for that matter, governments. I sometimes think of the analogy with globalization and free trade, under which a lot of these agreements are being toast. So we have global movement of capital, we have global movement of corporations, global movement of products, but the people are still restricted. The people do not have freedom of movement around the globe. You're stuck in the country where you were born. Until we redress this imbalance, we're going to continue to have issues like this, and I fear the issues will not be resolved in the favor of a democratic process. And that's my view and reaction.
Thanks, Stephen. I will throw the mic over to Mark now.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for inviting me to participate here. In listening to Michael Geist's talk, I was also curious to have him in the room, as it were, to be able to ask him some on-the-spot questions. But I do have a number of responses that I'd like to share to his talk. I'm going to paste the main points into the chat window. So the first one is a point that has also been made, not just in Geist's talk, but has also been made by the Swedish Pirate Party founder, Rick Falkvin.
Mark, I'm not sure if you accidentally hit the button or something, but you disappeared for a bit.
Yeah, George, thanks. I was just pasting some text into the chat window. It seems like I have to hold this talk button down to stay on here. If you have another way for me to do that, I'm all ears. But the point that Falkvinge makes, as does Michael Geist, is that what the particularly recent rounds of digital advocacy have done is to very effectively expose the various attempts to change copyright law for what they are, which are a kind of concerted attack on civil liberties. Okay, so, and as Geist indicates, these are not attacks, or these are not legislative initiatives and trade agreement initiatives that are going to let up anytime soon. So ACTA is now on the rocks. The U.S. is moving on to other potential targets with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? This is called forum shopping, and they will do it constantly until they get the laws that serve their interests. So it's not a fight that is anywhere near from over, as effective as it has yet been. Okay, yeah, I see how to toggle it. Thanks, George. The next point I want to make is that and this is a sort of more hopeful point, I think, is that I like to see the internet advocacy and protests going on now as a symptom, to some extent, of the shifting mediascape of popular culture. That is, as some op-eds had suggested in the wake of the SOPA protest, we are looking at a shift in what actually constitutes popular culture, which has traditionally been ruled by broadcast, structured content, and media. The internet has the potential to be changing that, has been busy changing that really since its inception, but very recently has become so dramatically more ubiquitous in people's everyday lives that it's almost as though people watch TV and go to movies to have something to tweet about or Facebook about rather than organizing their leisure activities around the more broadcast type entertainment media as the mainstay of popular culture. I wonder if we're seeing a shift in what actually constitutes popular culture. That's sort of an open standing question there. And related to that, perhaps an attempt to further shift the mediascape of popular culture towards the internet away from what has been characterized, perhaps in oversimplistic terms, as big content, the entertainment lobbies that speak for Hollywood and the music labels, for instance. This month, the hacker group Anonymous has been running what they call Black March, which is a protest, kind of a boycott. They've kind of glammed up what's basically a boycott, advising people to boycott any and all entertainment products from big content, such as Hollywood and music. They've been advising people not to buy music, not to go to movies. And a boycott is always a kind of a risky strategy and has certain assumptions that are problematic in terms of being grounded in consumerism and its ideologies and premises. But I think it's an interesting kind of move to suggest that one of the most effective ways to fight back against the persistence of these initiatives to change copyright law and internet law is to try to hit the companies behind these laws where they hurt, that is, in their profit margins. So the idea here was to try to make a visible dent in big content's profit margins for the first quarter of this year as a way to say, you know, quit it, with the draconian laws already. The success of that campaign remains to be seen, and I'd be curious to see if there's any reporting or analysis once the month is officially over in a couple of days. More immediately, the last point I want to make here is that the digital advocacy that we're seeing is, in some ways, a symptom of a fragmenting internet. As the laws governing the internet become more draconian and as efforts to change laws become more persistent, the internet itself could be substantially reshaped, fragmented really, in terms of moving away from a kind of centralized web experience towards something, if anything, more like what the internet used to be before the web, which was a series of different lower profile networks, such as Gopher, for instance, or other early tools like that. So I wonder if these laws are producing a proliferation of internets, of different networks, as a kind of formation that's far more distributed and not necessarily as integrated as what the World Wide Web currently offers today. I mean, this is the nature of what overregulation does. Overregulation of any particular sector will reliably drive its object further underground. And sometimes I wonder if that really is the object of laws and initiatives like this, to actually introduce legislation and trade agreements that are actively criminalizing larger portions of the population to satisfy other industrial sectors, such as the prison industrial complex. That might be veering a little too far into other areas in which I'm really not as expert, so I think I'll leave my response there in terms of the usefulness of digital advocacy in exposing copyright law as an attack on civil liberties, in terms of understanding the internet protests as symptom of the shifting mediascape of popular culture, and perhaps as also a symptom of a very different looking, differently shaped internet in the future. Anyway, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark. Tony, over to you.
Thank you, George. Michael's presentation made me think of the old expression, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And I'm really grateful that we have people around like Michael who's able to both understand the law and actually follow what's happening and give warnings to us all about what's happening. I find it pretty scary, actually. I find a lot of things about the internet increasingly scary, or things around the internet increasingly scary. I'm particularly concerned about individual privacy and the way that's being commercialized in particular. So I totally agree with Stephen, and that's not always true, is it, Stephen? But I do agree with you this time that the balance of the law is very much, surprise, surprise, overloaded towards large corporations and not focused enough on the rights of individuals. And the other thing that worries me here is the question of what to do as an individual. What do I do to protest these developments? First of all, often I'm unaware of these developments. I have no idea, for instance, what Facebook is doing with, if I was on Facebook, which I've come off now, but if I was on Facebook, I would have no idea what they're doing with my private data. I have no idea what Google is doing with my private data, and I can't come off Google for obvious reasons. So, you know, it's the right to know as much as the right to do. If I know, then I can act, but if I don't know, I can't act. And the second thing is the complexity of copyright law. Basically, we're trying to have one law that has to deal with a vast range of different problems, and I don't think that's good law. I'm not a lawyer, but, blanket laws never work very well. So what we've got is a copyright law that is focused on the entertainment industry particularly, and obviously there need to be some protections for companies that are investing $200 million in a movie that then fails. But on the other hand, do we need that same law to cope with educators trying to use media for teaching or for individuals trying to express a personal opinion and quoting other people, for instance? And I don't think we need one blanket law, but a number of different laws that would deal, or different bills or rights or articles of laws that would deal with different things. In Canada, we have both provincial and federal privacy commissioners, and I wanted to ask Michael, if he'd been around, what do you think their role is too narrowly prescribed at the moment? It's focused primarily on individual privacy and data, but it seems to me that there are some issues here around copyright as well, where somebody needs to speak for the individual rather than for the corporation. And I'm wondering if the Privacy Commissioner's role shouldn't be extended somewhat to deal with some of the issues that Michael is raising. And lastly, you know, it would be nice if we could get rid of the copyright law altogether. I mean, it would be nice if we could have free data and free media, and to be honest, I think the publishing industry in particular is using the law to try to protect an industry that is no longer valid. That doesn't have a valid business model now because of the internet, and so it's trying to use the law to protect its position, and that is very, very disconcerting. I think the same is true of the movie and music industries as well. So I agree with Stephen that we need to have and continue to press for more individual rights, but my worry is how to do that and how, as individuals, we can do that. So I'll stop at that point.
All right. Well, thanks to each of you for the overview or your opening statements. And so we certainly have, and certainly copyright and IP and law in general is certainly not going to be fully addressed in the short time that we have here. But perhaps if we could shift the direction a little bit, we've had arguments made around the issues of copyright law, civil liberties being attacked, the need for, as Stephen iterated and Tony supported, which is that the conversation around copyright and law is quite one-sided one way. It favors the institutions, often the content creators, and it essentially attacks the end users to varying degrees. So if we take the discussion we've had so far and we bring it into an educational context, what worries you most around the trajectory of copyright law or international IP? What worries you most about that from an educational context? So wide open question, anyone can jump in.
Can you restate the question, please, George? I didn't quite follow it.
Sure. No, I was just saying, if you look at the conversation that we've had around where copyright's trending and what the content owners are doing in terms of asserting their rights to assert control over the end user, things such as the three strikes policy or being able to essentially eliminate the rule of law in terms of how we are treated by corporations with our use of content. If you take that discussion and you shift it to the educational space, what are you most concerned about in terms of what do you fear will happen in the education space if we continue this trajectory?
I think it really depends on what you mean by the education space. I mean, typically we think about educational institutions, but as we discussed in the chat just at the very beginning of the conversation, it's not clear what side education institutions are on here. And certainly they're major producers of content, and as institutions, major producers of IP and patents, not so much trademarks, I guess. And so more and more may stand with the proponents of copyright clampdowns, and against what I would call individual liberties. So I think if I have to be asked what is the major fear that I have, it's essentially the eventual and oncoming ownership of education, with a capital E, by these interests. I'm not sure where to take that from here, but that's what I'll put on the table for now.
George, yeah, I think the universities are in a bit of a mess at the moment. They're split on the copyright law, and I think that's a big shame. Not surprising. I'm not surprised by it, but there are some real restrictions in that new law still on what academics can do and what they can't do in terms of and what students can download and reuse. I know UBC has one person full time being a digital policeman now, going around all the courses making sure the university and the professor isn't breaking the law, which is really concerning when you have to have somebody doing that. And because the law is so complex, most faculty just don't understand what it means. And again, that's the problem with a blanket one law trying to cover everything. Makes it extremely difficult for people to know how to interpret the law and what to do, because nobody's going to sit down and nobody's a lawyer and wants to go through every clause in a bill to make sure that they're within compliance. So and the problem is that we're all at risk now. We're all at risk of breaking that law because we don't really understand what's in it because it's so complex. And so I think it's a real inhibitor to the freedom of information and freedom of expression.
I'd just like to respond to that by noting, as somebody who has actually sat down and read through the bill as part of I did a weekend course on the upcoming bill, and it was a very interesting experience because there are actually a few different ways to read law when you get down to needing to interpret it. I should say I'm neither a lawyer nor a legal scholar, but it's always a very interesting experience to sit down and read through the text of the law, and something that emerged in our close reading of Bill C-11 is that while Geist has very legitimately voiced concern that the digital locks provisions will trump every other potential gain in the upcoming copyright law, another way to read the law in with reference not just to the text of the law itself, but also with reference to the court record and the record of recent decisions made in terms of copyright and education, there's an alternate reading that suggests that, at least in the educational context, fair dealing could trump the proposed digital locks provisions. So one particular thing I think we need to do as educators, first of all, is to better acquaint ourselves with the particular laws in question. It can be really boring reading. Nobody's going to tell you otherwise. But also to understand the particular provision that is fair dealing, which in the educational context has a history of enjoying fairly robust decisions made by the Supreme Court on behalf of, or finding rather in favor of, educational institutions rather than the private firms. So fair dealing is one particular part of the law that Geist has said stands to be expanded in the new law, and I think it's something that as educators we owe it to ourselves to look more closely at, because it's not the kind of provision we just get to keep if we never exercise it. We need to be a little aggressive, if anything, in how we understand and how we implement fair dealing and being able to copy one-off texts for classroom use, or enable, or in deciding that we want to show a video that maybe hasn't been institutionally cleared. You know, these are sort of ways to work within fair dealing provisions, which we do stand to gain a fair bit from under the new law. So there are a couple ways to read this particular problem of digital locks in the context of fair dealing, which in being clarified and in being brought closer to U.S. fair use could be a real game that we owe it to ourselves to find out about so that we can exploit it really to the full.
Great, thank you. And for others here, I just want to mention, if you'd like to take the mic, just above our names, there's a little hand. Just click that hand, and that'll let me know that you'd want to grab the mic and ask a question for a panelist or just in general to the audience. That's encourage you to do that as well. Now, one of the points that Stephen's touched on twice now, and I'd love to hear, particularly from Tony and Mark, and clarification from Stephen is fine as well, but it's this notion that the universities are really not clear on which side they're on. Are they on the side of the students, the educators, the end users of content, or are they increasingly moving to side with the copyright owners? So anybody want to tackle that one? Where are universities positioned now in this copyright or intellectual property discussion? And perhaps, where should they be positioned? So we'll throw that out open. Terry, if there's an open mic, feel free to take it whenever you'd like.
Well, George, I'd like to respond to that is that the problem when you say universities, as Stephen says, when we're talking about learning, obviously the institutions don't have a lock on learning. But when you're talking about education, it by and large is institutionally oriented. And so, as Tony noted, you know, the universities are not clear on that whole question. The faculty have some ideas, and some of that's a little based upon the proprietary or the pecuniary interest of them as authors and IP owners. But it seems like faculty by and large only care or will only get upset about academic freedom and about money issues. Whereas administrators seems like they have been almost completely silent when they have a lot to gain by opening up access. So it makes, unless they're, you know, under the consideration of corporate partnership kind of thinking, but they really shouldn't be. But I wonder if anybody could respond from the college or even the K-12 sector, because they don't have this long tradition of the faculty being IP owners, and yet they seem to be more or less silent on the this whole their rights and their use of fair right and the digital locks, or have I just missed their input?
Mike is yours, Tony.
It's Tony. I think Tony Radcliffe's got his hand up.
At this point, the only one I see with the hand up is yours, Tony, so feel free to take it away.
Okay. I just wanted to respond to Mark's point about fair dealing. And the problem is that fair dealing really requires definition by case law now. You know, it's not clear enough. You'll have to go to court. And going back to Terry's point, why administrators are being quiet about this, what they don't want is to be the first one in front of a judge, because that's going to cost the institution a huge amount of money. So I think, you know, the fair dealing law needs to be tested, particularly in Canada, but no university wants to be the first one up there. And I think that's what inhibits administrators, and that's why they're putting the digital police into place.
The universities have already come up in the court cases I alluded to. So the precedent case is Law Society, it was a 2004 case, Law Society of Upper Canada versus a copyright collective that alleged that the Law Society library was making unauthorized copies. But the Law Society's successful defense against that allegation and the consequent ruling for fair dealing, I mean, means that universities have really already been up against this, and there have been precedents established in Supreme Court law.
Well, so it seems like we're asserting that somebody needs to be responsible for pushing back. I think one of the biggest benefits that the content owners have in this regard is that they are organized, they have fairly deep pockets, and they're taking not just a, you know, local kind of view on this, but they're connected globally, which means that one of the biggest exporters of copyright law, if you will, is coming from, let's say, countries like US or areas like Europe or even countries like Canada, because they're forming these conglomerates, if you will, and they're pushing a fairly similar agenda around the world. So the difficulty, I think, that universities have, exactly what Tony touched on, is who's going to be the first to stand in line. And this is a game that, I mean, it really comes from patent trolls. So if you have a patent that someone says they own, as long as everyone stands up to it and is willing to fight, often the patent troll ends up failing. But if you have even a few small systems, that companies that start to say, okay, fine, I'll license that so-called patent from you, and then over time they start to own it, and then you know, as Microsoft is doing with Android, they're making more money off Android than Google is because of their patent enforcement. So I guess that's the challenge that I'd put out to the panel is, how do these individuals become organized, universities or educators or otherwise, to present an equally coherent voice to push back, so that because individually these systems will fall and sign on or do what Tony mentioned, have a full-time IP or copyright person basically serving the needs of corporate entities like Terry touched on as well, but they're being paid for by public funds. What does it look like? What kind of a model do we have that allows an ability to respond back to these IP interests?
Well, just one very modest and practical thing that I know a number of institutions are doing, and Athabasca is doing, is developing a fair dealing policy that is a public policy document that anybody at the university can refer to in terms of understanding how to implement and flex fair dealing for their own purposes. It's a way to indicate that it's a known quantity, it's a known privilege that the university is within its rights to exercise and to promote to its members. So that's one thing that we can do at the very practical policy level.
So if I, as an individual, appeal through and use Athabasca's policy and then lose my case in court, do I have any recourse to Athabasca? Probably not. It's one thing to have a policy, but you know, I mean, it's quite another to have one that you know if you follow, you'll be fine.
Yeah, Stephen, that's a very good point. The court records show there's really no there's no record of a collecting agency, such as, for instance, Access Copyright, for having ever gone after a particular individual. And the reason for that is simply money. And a particular individual exercising their fair dealing rights doesn't have the pocket deep enough for a collecting agency or a content rights holder to care about. So you'd think on that account they would go after institutions, but because the institutions are one of the main clients, or have been until recently, one of the main clients of a collecting intermediary like Access Copyright, neither does the court record show that Access Copyright in itself has gone after any institution. So it is an interesting area, and it's a problematic area. And it is admittedly a risky area, but the history of cases here does suggest that we have the law as a pretty strong defense.
Yeah, just to set the record straight, and George put it in the comments, there are cases of copyright collectors going after individuals. There were tons of individuals sued, and sometimes for very large amounts of money. By the RIAA over what was alleged to be copyright infringement, like the sharing of music. And there's a case, and again, I mentioned it in the chat area earlier on. I'm not sure if I still have the link here or not. I don't think I do. About the individual who lives in Britain who shared some links to some file sharing sites. Link. He wasn't actually sharing files, a practice that's perfectly legal under British law, and yet nonetheless was extradited and charged under U.S. law for breaking copyright. So the risks to individuals are indeed significant, and the lobby or the cartel has no hesitation to slap down any individual. There's also the case of, I think it's Jeff Tenenbaum, or it might be Mark Tenenbaum, I forget which, who was taken to court and convicted for downloading a large number of JSTOR articles. And that's interesting because these articles were freely available. And he was exercising a right that he had under the terms of end user terms of use, but they still took them to court. So what are you going to do?
Tony, I see your mic is open. Did you want to respond to that?
Actually, it was an accident, but I will comment, not so much on that, but one of the things that I wanted to go back to, what Michael raised earlier on, was how do we as individuals try to influence these laws? And I find that very difficult, I must admit, particularly over SOPA. I did actually make an effort to try to understand what SOPA was about, and I didn't know what to do. Should I have blacked out my website for the day like Stephen did? Probably I should have done, but I wasn't sure it would have made much difference. I have a feeling of impotence here. You know, I just really feel that it's really hard for individuals, even working together, to take on these very large corporations who seem to have tremendous power now to influence the law in their favor. And maybe I'm just alone on this, and maybe I should be doing more as a citizen to participate, but I do feel pretty powerless here, and I wonder if other people have that feeling as well.
I'll green check mark if you feel powerless in this space, and X if you don't. So it's just a top above our names. You can sort of drop in your response. I'm wondering if you could talk to Stephen or Mark or others. Why do you feel powerless? Like, what is it that makes you feel powerless in this discussion?
Just to update an earlier remark of mine, it was Aaron Schwartz, not Tenenbaum. Tenenbaum was charged with something else. I'd have to look that up separately. Aaron Schwartz with the JSTOR articles, and I've tossed a reference into there, and I see George has done one as well. What makes us feel powerless, George, is the fact that we are powerless. And increasingly so, as the inequity between rich and poor grows, and I'm actually one of the, speaking personally, I'm one of the more empowered in society. I actually have a decent job, at least for today. We'll see what tomorrow looks like. I have a good education, capacity to express myself, and yet I'm pretty much unable to influence public policy, despite those advantages. And I remember when I didn't have any of those things, and I wasn't even allowed in public buildings, much less unable to influence public policy. And that's the reality for most people in the world. And my own approach over the years has been to increasingly say that our answers are not going to be found in the institutions as they exist. These institutions will preserve and protect the existing order, and I don't think you can make change from within. And I haven't seen a successful example of this. And when you're within the institution, you're in a very vulnerable position. Believe me, I know, I'm in one. And the change that I make in the world isn't within this institution, but my own placement within the institution actually makes me more vulnerable. So, people ask me, where do you think the change in schools is going to happen? I say outside the schools. Where will the change in government happen? I have to say outside the government. And I think the only answer to any of these things is going to be, in the long run, to set up alternative and parallel systems, alternative and parallel systems of commerce, alternative and parallel systems of education, alternative and parallel systems of government. And, you know, even that is, you know, not a guaranteed path to success, because the existing system can and will do everything it can to maintain its monopoly. But I think it's the only hope. I think that if we want something new in education, we have to invent it for ourselves and set it up for ourselves and set it up outside the existing system, where and with the hope that if it has an underlying value, that this value will slowly, ever so slowly, permeate the existing system and turn the flow of co-option the other way, if you will. And beyond that, I actually see little hope. And I don't want to go off into a Dave Pollard funk and say, well, it's the end of civilization. But I do want to say that unless we get this right, unless we're able to change this imbalance of power, that it's not going to go well for many, many people. And, there will be long-term and serious social consequences, ranging from failure to deal with the environment to increasing anger on the part of people who've been dispossessed, to all the social problems that will follow from those two things.
All right, well, I guess Mark or Tony don't want to tackle that one in terms of the feeling of powerlessness or not, and the point of that Stephen raised about the way to change the institution is actually not to work within the institution, it's to work from outside building parallel systems. Certainly an interesting perspective, and one that I would imagine could well take a long period of time, but be interesting to tackle that one a little bit deeper. Mark, over to you.
Oh, it just it occurs to me in reflecting on Stephen's comments that something that occurs to me from time to time is that technology is showing itself, for better or worse, to keep itself at least one step ahead of the law. So that is clearly one of several systems in play in how the powerless can, you know, seize some of the power in limited ways. So this internet fighting back phenomenon is one example of that. And of course there are better and worse examples of technology prompting changes in the law or subverting the law or whatnot. But if as I said earlier, we need to pay much closer attention to the laws themselves, then what I think a venue like this that we're sharing today suggests is that a similar vigilant attention to technology, its affordances, its limits, and certainly the terms of service that govern it, as somebody mentioned in the chat thread a little while ago. Also, all of these things require not just our vigilant attention, but our creative adaptation and appropriation in order to make them, you know, work for the 99%, not the 1%.
I noticed that S. Law has asked a really good question about student works that infringe copyright. And again, that's an interesting point. And one of the things I've been looking at recently is what's happening inside learning management systems and what's happening outside them. And one of the very good things about a learning management system is that it stays private. So if students do copy illegally and post it within the privacy of the learning management system, it may still be legal, but it's less likely to lead to prosecution and so on of either the student or the institution. So it's one of the few arguments I can see in favor of privacy within online teaching, is that it does allow a much freer way of communicating. And one of the things I heard frequently from faculty, particularly in business, was the comment that you know, one thing we need is to have that freedom of expression. We can actually criticize companies online within the learning management system. If we go outside that in blogs and so on, we're liable to prosecution and so on. So and that's quite an interesting spin on learning management systems that I hadn't seen before. It gives more freedom to work within that closed space, which is not open to the public. So I'd be interested in what other people feel about that. But I think there is protection for students within the learning management system, if nothing else.
I'd like to respond, Tony, briefly to that. It's just that I think you're quite right, and that's one of the values of having a special and that has been a traditional function of universities is a refuge for scholarship. But at the same time, the problem with the LMS is that the student cannot decide to open up to the world, and I think that there is no one right privacy setting. What's freedom of speech for one person is an infringement on privacy or a copyright infraction for another. So I think the only really good systems are those that allow individuals to decide how open or how close, not the system that the institution particularly uses.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting because I think there will be some cases soon, because I've noticed that Marxist faculty aren't ready to open up their classrooms. But for instance, UBC has a very interesting site now called UBC Wiki. A very large number of the online courses have this publicly open space, which is presumably password. To get into the space, you have to have a password. But anybody can read this, and you can apply for a password even if you're not a student to participate in that discussion. And I think eventually we will see some court cases coming out over people being criticized in open blogs and open wikis from universities, and it will be very interesting to see how that plays out in a court of law. You know, you've got the free speech versus people's right, personal rights not to be libeled and so on. And I think it is an interesting issue. I do see it coming up, and I'm not sure if the law is in a position yet where the balance is going to be right in these cases.
All right, well, we've got about 4 minutes left. So what I'd like to do in the last 4 minutes is just give each of you an opportunity, our panelists, to provide sort of a quick summary, a few concluding thoughts, and then we wrap up as we turn it over to the next session that I believe is going to take an opportunity to go into a little bit more detail around this topic. We're going to look at the learning technology exploration. Sorry, I'm not sure who just dove in there. I cut them off as they were speaking. Anyway, so we're going to look a little bit at Athabasca University Open Press, publishing open access journals, and then the 12:30 to 1 session will be John Drawn looking at open learning through social media, which will have relevance to the topic that we just raised toward the end here. But let's give each of our presenters here about a minute or so to do some concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I think I came over unduly negative when I said I felt powerless. But I feel powerless in terms of influencing public legislation. That's where I feel powerless. I feel empowered in terms of what the internet allows me to do at the moment. And what I fear is having that power taken away from me. And so I think it's made me more determined this session to be more active in protecting my freedoms, and I hope freedoms of everybody else on the internet. So that's what I'd like to say as a way of ending.
Yeah, I want to follow up and say pretty much the same thing. Without the internet, I don't get this job. I don't get to talk with all of you. I don't really get much more than a career in the hospitality industry, which is a fine career, and I was very happy when I worked in restaurants, but this is better. And my fear is losing this, not this job or this career particularly, but losing the capacity that I have now to express myself, to make my opinions known, to change, if not public policy, that would be forever beyond my reach, but to change minds and reach people. And I think of myself today not so much as speaking to society of today as speaking to the future, in the hope that the capacity that allowed me to express my views today may ultimately in the long term allow society to change in a wider way tomorrow. These things take time, and we all understand that. And my concern is that society will go the other way, and that these words and the words of my contemporaries and those in the Occupy movement and those of the Arab Spring and all the rest of it will be silenced, and that we'll move to a society which is dull and gray and ordered and structured. And that would be a sad thing, I think. So what's my final word on this? The last thing I give up, and I hope they never take it from me, is my capacity to laugh and make fun of the system. And as long as I have that, I think I have at least the basis for a future democracy that I'll need.
Thanks. I'll just reiterate that I think we need to pay particular attention to fair dealing. After all, if we want to continue to be able to laugh, it will afford us new provisions for parody and satire. So, but in all seriousness, I think that as educators looking at dramatic changes to copyright, fair dealing is one particular and concrete part of the law, technology, education equation that really demands our very focused attention to be able to continue to function in open and closed environments, and to continue the fight against overly draconian copyright legislation. Thanks for inviting me to join this.
All right, well, thanks all. If I could ask audience members here, if you go up to the icon just above our names that looks like a smiley face right now, but if you drop down, click on that drop down, you get the applause option. So if I could just ask you to join me in thanking our presenters for a terrific session, some great comments, and certainly a conversation that needs to be ongoing down the road.